Now to today's local headlines. Earlier today, the chair of D.C.'s Committee on Human Services, Ward 6 Councilmember Tommy Wells, withdrew his emergency legislation which would have required families to prove district residency before being sheltered. Wells, however, does plan to move forward with similar legislation, but not on an emergency basis. Wells discussed the withdrawal of his emergency legislation before the D.C. Council's Committee of the Whole earlier today.
Mr. Chair, today I'm introducing the Homeless Services Reform Amendment Act of 2010. Our city's facing an immediate crisis, as many cities are across America, regarding the provision of severe weather shelter for our residents. We have only two weeks to go before the start of hyperthermia season. D.C. General is already at capacity, sheltering between 130 and 133 families nightly. At this time last year, there were only 35 families sheltered at D.C. General. This number increased to 200 families last year during the hypothermia season. As of today, we have no room to receive more families at D.C. General. But at a time when every D.C. resource is stretched thin for our residents and families, I'm very troubled that we've been able to determine that 10% of the families served in the last 6 months were from outside the district. I'm also concerned, as we provide apartments for our homeless families, that we are using the apartments for D.C. residents. I plan on holding a hearing on the bill quickly, Mr. Chair, and I'll continue to work with the agency and the community on a legislative response to the crisis. In light of the budget shortfall, there will be no easy answers, but we need to enact measures that will help preserve scarce public resources for D.C. residents. I'd planned on moving emergency temporary legislation today, but to ensure a greater discussion and prevent any unintended consequences on this important effort, I'll withdraw those bills for today.
Ward 6 Councilmember Tommy Wells and Chair of the Committee on Human Services withdrawing his emergency legislation earlier today. Also at the D.C. Council today was Patty Malahi-Fougere, Executive Director of the Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless. Fougere described the impact of Wells' legislation and the importance of it being withdrawn.
Councilmember Wells pulled from the council agenda today an emergency bill that would have imposed what we think is some pretty onerous criteria for admission into emergency severe weather shelter. He wants to impose a residency requirement and that requires proof of residency. And we think that's going to be a significant barrier to a lot of the folks that for the 20 years this district has been focusing on a winter plan and preventing hypothermia deaths. The folks who were the target of those plans are going to be kept out of shelter. Some of the most hardcore street-bound homeless folks are not going to be able to comply with the requirements or are going to misunderstand the requirements and not be willing to go inside. And I think for certain we would see deaths this winter if this bill went forward without some kind of additional thought process, without an opportunity for public input to see what the real consequences might be. And so by pulling the legislation today and introducing it as a permanent bill, there'll be an opportunity for a hearing so that we can make sure that the bill gets at what the real issues are and understands what the real issues are. He based the bill on numbers of out-of-jurisdiction families who are allegedly trying to milk this homeless system of resources, and the numbers are so confusing. They're a moving target. We hear 10% of applicants, 10% of residents, 10% of Tier 1 priority families. There's no clarity about what the numbers are, and I think we have to really pin down what the facts are before we design some changes to a system that might have deadly consequences, and having a hearing will allow us to do that.
The Washington Post reports that the D.C. area is among the hardest hit when it comes to the income of part-time workers. Quote, part-time workers in the Washington region suffered some of the worst pay losses in the nation during the recession, even as full-time employees held their ground. The recession has thrust millions of Americans who once held full-time jobs into the category of part-timers as they lost jobs, worked fewer hours, or became self-employed when their employers trimmed costs. They are considered underemployed, and they do not show up in unemployment statistics because they are working, though not as much as they would like or need, end quote. The Washington Post also reports that, quote, D.C. public schools have started serving an early dinner to an estimated 10,000 students. many of whom are now receiving 3 meals a day from the system as it expands efforts to curb childhood hunger and poor nutrition. Free and reduced price breakfast and lunch long have been staples in most urban school systems. But the district is going a step further in 99 of its 123 schools and reaching nearly a quarter of its total enrollment. Montgomery and Prince George's counties also offer a third meal of the day in some schools, but not on the scale undertaken in D.C., end quote. Will D.C. have an elected attorney general? While the issue has not been discussed much in the media, the charter amendment is on the ballot this November for district voters. Presently, D.C.'s attorney general is appointed by the mayor. One of those who has been working hard to change this, to an elected attorney general is Dave Maloff, a civic activist and second vice president of the Federation for Citizens Associations. 3 years ago, Maloff helped to get the push for an elected attorney general in D.C. going with this testimony before the D.C. Council.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
I'm David Maloff. I'm a 24-year resident of the District of Columbia, and I'm here to comment briefly on the potential need to restructure the Attorney General's office in a manner more like the Attorneys General in the other 50 states. In nearly every state, the Attorney General is more independent and protected from the day-to-day influence of the executive branch than here in D.C. 43 states engage in direct popular election of AGs with concomitant protections against undue day-to-day executive or legislative branch influence or termination at will, as I understand it. In 5 states, the governor appoints the AG, and there are also term protections against at-will firing and undue influence. And in 2 other states, Maine and Tennessee, another method is chosen, either by the legislature or the Supreme Court. In D.C., the AG serves totally at the pleasure of the mayor and can be terminated at will. Conclusion on my part is that your committee and the government should consider restructure with this potential new attorney general. And one of the reasons for considering that would be I am a bit concerned as a resident on the recent actions by the incoming AG nominee that suggest perhaps a bit more distance is needed between the attorney general and the executive here in D.C.
What will be the fate of Franklin Shelter? A little more than 2 years ago, the men who stayed at Franklin Shelter were evicted just a month before hypothermia season. Many felt Franklin Shelter was closed in order to transfer the public building to a developer. The shelter is located at 13th and K Streets Northwest in downtown D.C. and has now sat empty for the past 2 years. Yesterday, D.C.'s Office of the Deputy Mayor for Planning and Economic Development sent a memorandum which reads, quote, "The district will conduct a public hearing to receive public comments on the proposed surplus of the Franklin School building," end quote. The hearing for the historic Franklin School shelter will take place Thursday, November 18th at Thompson's Elementary School. This evening at Martin Luther King Jr. Library in downtown D.C. is the grand opening of the public archives for WISH, Washington Inner City Self-Help. WISH worked for the empowerment of low-income communities in the district from 1978 to 2003. Also this evening, D.C. Council Chairman and presumptive Mayor-elect Vincent Gray continues his listening tour. Tonight's Ward 1 Town Hall is taking place at Carlos Rosario Public Charter High School beginning at 6:30 p.m. Mr. Gray's next town hall will be Thursday evening in Ward 8 at Matthews Memorial Baptist Church. Already taking place this evening is a candlelight vigil in honor of Ali Ahmed Muhammad. Muhammad, a 27-year-old from Silver Spring, died after being beaten some 30 feet from the U Street nightclub, DC 9. Among those joining Muhammad's family this evening at 9th and U Street, Northwest, is radio talk show host Abebe Balu.
We, the Ethiopian community who live around the Washington metro area, we are demanding fair justice on behalf of our brother, Muhammad. As you know, he's died by cowardly acts of DC-9 employees and owner. Today, 6 p.m., we'll have a candle night, a vigil night, here in DC9 Club. Everybody is invited to be there to show support for our brother Muhammad and his family. And we demand justice according to the law of the United States. And I hope it will happen. But the rumors and everything what we hear is not nice. We are really angry at the cases now being reduced to the lower level That's not acceptable. We demand fair justice, and we will show up today at 6 p.m. for a candle vigil with Muhammad's family and the rest of the Ethiopian community in metro area. Anybody who's listening to this, please welcome to join us.
Yesterday was the funeral for Mildred Millie Edwards, a longtime community activist in the Shan neighborhood who worked to rebuild the city after the 1968 riots. Dorothy Brazil, a veteran D.C. journalist and executive director of D.C. Watch, discussed the history of the building of Metro's Green Line and the role that Millie Edwards played in lessening the displacement it caused to Washingtonians.
Well, the first line, the segment of the Green Line that was the inner city line built by Metro, came up 7th Street and made the turn onto U Street. The contract that Metro let for the project essentially let the contractor do cut and cover, which essentially he dug a big trench to put in the station and the tunnels and the track. Metro got into a dispute with the contractor, who then walked away for several years. And so both 7th Street in Shaw and U Street in the U Street corridor were simply no man's land. Businesses went out of business. There was no sidewalk. They put down wooden planking to cover the muddy holes. Rats were running around, big as cats. I met Millie around that period of time because the next segment of the Green Line was going to be built from U Street to Columbia Heights and out to Petworth. And we were bound and determined in Columbia Heights not to have the devastation that was caused in Shaw. And as a result of working with Millie and some other people in the community, we got Metro to devise a completely different construction method. Rather than cut and cover and building a trench, they brought a drilling machine from Japan, and essentially the rest of the Green Line from U Street out to Fort Totten was dealt with was built by a drilling tool. And indeed, 14th Street was never closed down. There were never any houses taken as a result of the construction project. So Millie had an invaluable impact on the community that has benefited ever since, both in Shaw, the U Street corridor, Columbia Heights, and Petworth.
Those are some of the local headlines here on Spectrum today. I'm Pete Tucker, filling in for Askia Muhammad.